Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday before Veterans Day. State investigators are reviewing a police shooting on the Bad River Reservation that resulted in a teen's death this week. Ashland County Sheriff's deputies responded to a call of a suspect walking with a knife Wednesday morning in Odena. The responding deputy fired shots, striking and killing 14-year-old Jason Pirro. The officer involved was uninjured. Yesterday, I spoke with Bad River Tribal spokesman Dylan Jennings by phone about how the community is dealing with his loss.
So we come from a very small community, but a very unified community. Bad River is notorious for being able to come together and our community members step up to take care of each other in tragedy and in time of need, and that's what we're seeing going on up here. It's a very, very difficult time for us all, but you know, our community is helping the family, helping our members and some of our staff that need it, and we're trying to move forward in the best way we know how, with love and compassion.
And what have you been doing today as part of that to provide support to community members or to the students who knew Jason?
Yeah, so our clinic and some of our staff, you know, we've been offering services, you know, counseling, grief support, and other forms of services for our community and for even outside community members that need that. We've also been very vigilant and proactive in the schools. So we've been working with the school district and the various schools that have been, you know, very affected, in the youth that, you know, are very, very close to him as well. So we've been trying to do that, and we will continue to do so, have a presence in there and continue to do what we can to support our young people and the family at this time.
Ashland Middle School students are grieving the loss of their 14-year-old classmate. Ashland School Superintendent Keith Hilt says around 70 middle school students were absent on Thursday. I spoke with him by phone yesterday on how school staff, community, and tribal members are offering support to students.
You know, I was over there this morning at the middle school and the high school in particular, and we had a lot of supports in place and you know, offered students you know, what they needed. You know, so some students over there today are you know, they wanted to do academic work and not think about, you know, Jason's death. Others needed to, you know, speak to some mental health providers that were on hand. Others just needed to talk with, you know, with friends and their teachers. And then of course, many of them, you know, they would move from one activity to another. So a lot of sorrow, a lot of fear, you know, that you know, a fellow 14-year-old child, you know, could die. Anger, there was some anger, you know, that this happened, and unfortunately, you know, some anger directed toward law enforcement. And so the range of emotions, you know, covers the whole gamut. Like I said, I was in some classrooms this morning, and I was really impressed with our middle school principal, Jake Levin. He created a nice plan for the day with the teachers, and then he created a video that, because he knew that the teachers would have a hard time, you know, processing this with their students. And so he created this video that was very compassionate and informative and calming, and they shared that. And then the teachers, you know, processed with their students and asked and, you know, affirmed with the kids that, you know, whatever you're feeling is okay. You know, they validated you might feel anger or fear or sorrow or just numb, and that's okay. You know, and we don't want to judge others for how they feel or how they react, because they're just doing what they need to do to get by. So there was a lot of support. It was well done. I can't thank the teachers and the principals and the other staff. You know, the secretaries and the custodian, they all pitch in and help the kids. So it was good to see them come together.
You mentioned a video. What was the video about?
Well, it covered a lot of topics. You know, first of all, you know, we wanted the students to know that we care about them and we cared about Jason. And, you know, if we go back to academic work, it doesn't mean we don't care. And again, it was a message about, you know, that whatever you're feeling is okay. Part of the message dealt with, you know, social media and how we really need to be careful in how we use it, because, for instance, there was an awful video that was going around on social media here, and students would see it and share it, and we addressed that, saying, you know, you're just curious and want answers, but in doing so, you're hurting people who were close to Jason. So trying to build that empathy in students and understanding, you know, this is a big adult topic that we're trying to have, you know, 12, 13, and 14-year-olds process. So it was about that. And then just, you know, some informative things about the, you know, what's today going to look like, what's tomorrow going to look like. So just giving information, to kind of answer as many questions as we could.
Did you know Jason?
Not well, no. I had a meeting over there yesterday morning at 10 o'clock, and Jason, I mean, I know who he was, and he was sitting at a table in the lunchroom, and I said, good morning, and he didn't really answer me, and I looked, and they said, well, he's ill, he's going home. So, you know, because that normally, you know, Jason's he had a good sense of humor. So, you know, yesterday I saw him in the morning, and then, of course, whatever happened later that day happened. We don't have any real facts about that.
What's the next step for you and the school as things go forward, I guess?
Well, our plan is to, again, offer support tomorrow. We'll bring in some, like I said, we have wonderful relations with our neighbors, you know, Memorial Medical Center and North Lakes and other, other organizations that deal with mental health. They sent staff over, other school districts sent staff over. Bad River youth workers came to talk with kids today. So we're going to bring, you know, those resources back, because we had about 70 students out who did not come to school today, and they're going to be coming back, and they may need some support. So we'll offer those supports for the next several days. Tomorrow's an unusual day because we have our annual Veterans Day celebrations, and they're a really big deal. There's one at every school, and we discussed whether we should or should not have those, and we decided we should, because it's a positive opportunity for the community to come together, celebrate our veterans. Jason was a part of the drumming group that was scheduled to perform at the middle school, and we talked to the leader of that group, and he said, yeah, they would like to still perform, and we'll recognize Jason at tomorrow. And then Saturday is our annual fall powwow. So the Bad River community comes and shares, you know, their cultural, you know, ceremonies with us. And they're also going to have a Veterans Day powwow. So Saturday is going to be a long day at the Ashland High School. And then next week we'll monitor the kids' needs, but we'll have some support available. You know, what many students want is they just want to kind of get back to routine. And so, you know, kids will be back in classes, and we'll be doing more academics and then addressing their needs as they come up.
Is there anything else that you want to share from the perspective of people who knew him or students who knew him?
Well, you know, he was in the middle school band, and he was in very much interested in his culture and in drumming. I talked to the leader of the drum group this morning, and Jason was interested in taking his drumming to the next level and performing at powwows. And so, you know, we've lost a star in that respect, and, you know, a lot of sorrow with did I already tell you, I mean, this is the fourth unexpected tragic death in Bad River this fall. And so it's just piling on the sorrow and anger and frustration, and why does all this have to happen? And, so, you know, he's going to be missed, and the community's really struggling. You know, they had a nice vigil last night. I wasn't able to attend, but a number of our staff did, and it was well attended and very emotional. And that work, you know, those meetings will continue, at least for the next few days. So.
I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, Keith.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I guess there'd be one more message, for families. If educators really care about kids and they're really good at supporting them. And so if there are families who are struggling and their children are struggling, let us know. And we're certainly here to help and work together to grow and heal from this.
Bad River Tribal Chairman Robert Blanchard has questioned why the deputy used deadly force. Agents with the Wisconsin Department of Justice are investigating the shooting, and they plan to release their findings to the Ashland County District Attorney within the next month. We turn now to Superior, where educators and nonprofits are holding an event next week to raise awareness about opportunities that are lacking for low-income kids and families. It's called Opportunity Rising, Our Promise to All Our Kids. The Duluth Superior Area Community Foundation is putting on a dinner beginning at 5:30 next Monday evening at Northern Lights Elementary School in Superior. They hope to draw more attention to the challenges facing families in the city. Joan Keeler-Pellman is among those taking part. She's the Assistant Early Head Start Director for the private nonprofit Family Forum, which serves low-income families across northern Wisconsin. I spoke with her by phone yesterday about their work and the issues confronting the families they serve.
Family Forum Incorporated is the Head Start and Early Head Start program for families that are primarily low income in the five northern counties of Wisconsin. So we have a center-based program for our 3- and 4-year-olds, and that's when kids come in 5 days a week, either for 4 hours or 6 hours a day, and it's a preschool program, so we're working with kids. And then our home-based program is we have a home visitor that goes in once a week, works with the parent to really support the parent in their work as a parent, because we really believe within our agency that parent is the child's first and forever teacher. So we want to support the parent, and if they're having struggles just in parenting, if they're having struggles in finding housing, that home visitor goes in and works with them, helps set some goals, and helps find community resources.
Okay. And so what do you see when you're working with families or in the work that you've done with families? What are some of the most pressing issues that they're facing?
Housing is huge. And I guess maybe it's not just housing, but it's affordable housing, especially when you're working with low-income families. There's only a certain number of low-income housing within our areas. And I have to say, Superior, we're struggling with that. Ashland, because we service families there, we struggle with that. So if you're low-income and you're working, minimum wage or even $9 or $10 an hour, and you get into low-income housing, I think it's like 30% or 35% of your income goes right towards paying your rent, right? However, many of our families have experienced other challenges in their lives that maybe law enforcement has been involved. So if a family, mom or dad, has a record, then you can't get into low-income housing within the areas. So then you're stuck in paying, maybe $1,000 a month for a housing unit that is old housing stock. There may be, you could get me going on this. I mean, there could be mold within the building, they could have lead pipes and all that issues that challenges that brings. If you're using water that has lead in it, because that causes developmental delays with kids and, all that stuff that happened in Michigan, right, with the lead in the water. We have old housing stock here in Superior, and that's something that we constantly are checking or asking parents to get the blood lead done on kids, especially parents that are moving around a lot. So affordable housing is huge. And we see many families doubling up or tripling up. So there's one family or two or three families living in one house to help pay the rent, So that's a huge issue I think our families are facing. And then another issue is childcare. Childcare primarily for infants and toddlers. We have many families who want to work, yet to find a child care provider for kids under the age of 2 is a challenge because there just isn't the providers here. And when the kids are younger, you as a provider can only service fewer kids. So, and there's, you know, it's not a money-making business. If you were a family provider or even a group daycare provider, the older the kid, the more you can take. But for an infant or toddler, you can only take 4 kids to 1 adult. And I think that the shortage of child care here across all of our counties is a huge issue.
And do you feel like it's the regulation then that's really preventing, you know, more services from popping up? Or what do you think seems to be the issue with that?
I think it's lack of early child care providers. I think it's the reimbursement rate that if families are using state child care funds, I don't think the providers are reimbursed. You know, infants and toddlers take more time because they're little, right? And they demand more care, which they should because they're little. But, the families we work with are low-income families, and some of them need some supplemental funds to help because to help them pay for child care, but I don't believe our state reimbursement rate helps that. And then again, I think it's not a money-making business to go into child care. So we don't have family child care homes that are opening up. More of them are closing. I think I was just looking at some data on the Department of Children and Families website of the number of family homes that have been closing over the past 5 years. It has drastically declined just because I think the people who did it are getting older and they're not wanting to care for kids anymore, or they can't, and we're not seeing any the newer or the younger generation opening up family homes anymore. So I think it's a bigger systematic issue. It isn't just one thing I think that's causing.
So what are families forced to do then in the meantime if we don't have an adequate number of child care centers around?
Well, so that's a huge struggle. So, you know, again, we want families to work, and families want to work. Parents want to work. So they kind of piecemeal child care together. You know, they use friends, they use family. Maybe they take their child to child care one day a week because that's all the opening that they have. Or they don't work. They can't work because they can't find child care for their kids. You know, within our program, we have 2 of our centers, but again, this is 3- and 4-year-olds that we expanded, and we are now doing extended days. So we're doing 6-hour days versus the 4 that we've done in our other centers to help with that situation. And I truly believe we're going to continue to change and adjust and add more time for our preschool kids. But I also think as an agency, we're going to need to really be looking at what can we do to provide and fill in some of these services for our early Head Start families too. So can we do early Head Start center base, and what is that going to cost, and how can we, you know, do our facilities we have now going to fit that? So those are a lot of questions that as an administration within our agency we've been asking ourselves.
So for these families, too, that you serve, is it the cost of child care that also is a barrier for them?
Oh, definitely. Definitely, yeah. Yeah. So, and again, if they're using, you know, the SHARES program, I think that's what it's called through the state, there is some reimbursement for families for that, or it goes right to the child care provider. But there's a lot of hoops to go through to get into that SHARES program, and if your child care provider accepts that from the state, that's another challenge. And then if you're using unregulated or friends or families and you're trying to pay for child care, that's another challenge or barrier in that too.
Well, what do you think needs to be done then, or what are some of the solutions that you feel could address the problems that families are facing in the area?
I don't know if I have that answer. I think as a community, we need to come together, and I think that's part of what we look for within our organization. We bring parents together once a month. We talk about what their issues are. How do they see what's happening in their community? How can they become advocates for themselves and for their children? And I, I think we all have to be, we as communities and citizens need to be open to that and to listen to everyone. I sometimes think our families that are low income or live in poverty feel they're not heard. And I think somehow we've got to figure out how to give them the voice and have them be heard by, you know, people who can make change within our communities, in our counties, and probably in our state, too. We need bigger changes within the state about probably child care regulations. You know, how can we get more people interested in becoming child care providers? You know, do we go to some of the big companies, you know, I don't know, Quick Trip or, you know, the hospital or the schools and say, what can we provide? Or how can we support these families in finding child care? Can we, you know, and again, like I said, within our agency, we're looking at what can we do with the funding we have coming in to adjust our services to meet the needs of these families.
And so what are you hoping comes of the dinner that's coming up on Monday then?
Well, I'm excited. I hope that we have a good community turnout so people can come in and understand what our families are struggling with and what we can do as a community to support each other and support families who are struggling.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me about the work that you're doing and what families in the area need. Is there anything else that you want to add?
Can I put a plug in that we're still taking applications for our program? So families, all they have to do is give our office a call or they can apply online. Again, we're here to support families. It isn't just the child education piece. We really recognize that that child comes from a family unit, and in order for that child to be healthy and happy, that family needs to be that too. So we've got openings in our early Head Start program and in our Head Start program. So if anyone's interested, you know, please contact us, and we'll help them through the application process and hopefully be able to provide some services.
Well, thanks so much, Joan. I really appreciate you taking time to talk to me today.
Well, thank you.
Again, that was Joan Keeler-Pellman with Family Forum. The community dinner kicks off next Monday evening at 5:30 at Northern Lights Elementary School in Superior. And in case you were wondering, there are 1,038 children living in poverty in the city, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from opposing sides on Wisconsin's debate over sulfide mining. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday before Veterans Day. Industry advocates are celebrating the legislature's repeal this week of a decades-old mining moratorium on sulfide mines. The moratorium required companies that wanted to mine sulfide ores like copper and gold to prove others had been operated and closed for 10 years without pollution. The Wisconsin Senate passed a bill to repeal that this week, and it's now headed for Governor Scott Walker's desk. He is expected to sign off on it. Up next, we hear from Lucas Weber about his thoughts on what that means for industry. Weber is General Counsel and Director of Environmental and Energy Policy with Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce.
Yeah, we think this is a huge step forward. It opens the door to a $1 billion industry in our state, an industry that we had closed the door to 20 years ago. And we're very excited to see if the legislature has again changed our state's policy to allow that type of investment to come here in the future. And we are hopeful that we'll get a good look from some of these companies who are bringing that investment right now to our neighboring states. We would hope that some of that investment would flow right here to Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I guess I'm just wondering if you have been talking at all with any companies or have heard any buzz about, you know, since this legislation has been introduced, if there's consideration now of starting up projects or moving ahead with that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I certainly can't speak for any individual company, but I know there are a number that have been working with the Department of Natural Resources. I think the DNR even has a website dedicated to some of the deposits in our state and what could be present there. And, you know, with this change, I think it opens the door to the type of significant investment that can lead to some prospecting activity, and then hopefully someday down the road, hopefully not too distant down the road, opening an actual mine here in Wisconsin again.
And, you know, in your conversations, I imagine that you've had conversations with companies in the past, right?
Yeah, you know, I've spoken as the bill was moving forward. I mean, there were a number of, spoke with a number of people on all sides of it, including some of the mining companies, absolutely.
So in your conversations with them, what did you hear that they were most looking to see if mining moves forward here in Wisconsin? Or if
and again, you know, I can't speak for the mining companies, but I can tell you that the purpose of the bill was to give certainty to the types of significant investment that's going to have to be made to bring mining activity to Wisconsin. I think, you know, to get a company to come in here and make that kind of investment and the resources, the people, the time, frankly, to prepare an application without any guarantee that they would even get a decision on such an application, you know, either up or down. They just need to be able to plan for their timeline of it. That's what this bill does. It sets a timeline, a very reasonable timeline, gives the DNR ample opportunity to request more information and, frankly, say no if that's the ultimate decision. But all parties involved will have the benefit of having a final decision on a time certain with this bill, which was a big deal, and it was very important to create the atmosphere that would be necessary to, again, just attract that significant investment.
And, you know, what do you say to opponents who say that this bill or the legislation would threaten the environment in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I think throughout the bill process, we've seen a lot of hyperbole, a lot of rhetoric that comes from groups in particular who are just opposed, frankly, to metallic mining. You know, our daily lives, Wisconsin and throughout the nation, throughout the world, rely on mined materials to move forward. We're only going to need more in the future, you know, whether it's copper or any of the other materials that are available in northern Wisconsin. We will need those, and Wisconsin can provide those. We can do it much safer here in Wisconsin, where we have amongst, if not the single most stringent environmental standards in the world. Whereas, you know, now some of those materials are mined in countries that have nowhere near the same standards that we have. I've said time and time again that if anybody's actually for protecting the environment, we should be clamoring to do the mining here in Wisconsin, where we know we can do it right, we can do it safely, and we've shown in the past that we can do it safely. So, and I think this bill has been called scientifically and environmentally sound by a number of groups, including former DNR Secretary George Meyer, which was important, and I give the authors a lot of credit for, after the initial public hearing, sitting down with people on both sides of the bill and saying, hey, how do we address some of these concerns? How do we make this bill better? And they did that, and there were a number of amendments. And then even again with the final amendments that was worked out last week to get that you know, again, addressed concerns and improved the bill. And I think they did a lot of work, and it was great legislating, and I think they deserve a lot of credit for coming up with a final product that absolutely protects our environment, but also opens the door to the type of economic development that can really drive our state.
And what are you hoping happens as we move forward now, and this heads to the governor's desk?
Well, you know, I think hopefully the governor will sign it. We expect that he will. And then we are hoping that some of these companies that have been investing significantly in our neighboring states would give Wisconsin a look and come here and begin working with our governments, our communities at all levels, and see if this is an opportunity that they could take advantage of here in Wisconsin. I mean, you know, there's no, I don't think there's any kind of expectation that any sort of a mine is going to pop up overnight, or, you know, that we're going to have a mining application in overnight here. This is a lengthy process that's going to involve a lot of teamwork and participation from governments of all levels throughout the state. So I think hopefully the ball can get rolling on that soon, and some of these projects can start being vetted and make sure that they are, you know, good for our states, and that would be, I think, the hope in the near future here.
And while industry advocates are celebrating the move, environmental groups fear it will mean contamination of Wisconsin's water resources. Bill Davis is the director of the Sierra Club's John Muir chapter in Wisconsin. He had this to say about the decision to repeal the state's mining moratorium.
Well, we're obviously disappointed, and I would, however, like to send a shout-out to Senator Coles, who's the only Republican who voted against it. I mean, you know, as we've said all along, we just think this is a really big mistake for northern Wisconsin. And it is a lifeline to a single foreign corporation that we think, you know, wants to potentially develop at least one site in Wisconsin and needed to show progress because they have a huge balloon payment due next year. But none of that gets away from the fact that sulfide mining, particularly in a wet environment like Wisconsin, is going to create acid mine drainage and, you know, very, very, very high likelihood of heavy metal contamination. And, the, you know, passing this law opens the state up to that possibility in a way that was not the case before.
When you're talking about a foreign corporation, are you talking about Aquila?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, they're a Canadian corporation.
So you think that this legislation was crafted and introduced and all just to benefit one company?
Yeah, I mean, Aquila admitted, you know, a few months ago that they were involved in the drafting of the legislation. So not hard dots to connect.
And you're talking about the deposit in Marathon County then?
Yes.
Okay. What do you think should happen next then? You know, this is going to go to the governor's desk. What would you like to see happen?
Well, I mean, we'd love it if he would veto it, but we so far have had no inclinations that that's likely. And assuming that he signs it, then it's going to fall back to local governments to take a look at this and see if there are any ways that they can craft local ordinances or things like that to potentially protect themselves from the adverse impacts of mining. And, you know, and that's all well and good, but part of, you know, part of our concern about that kind of an approach is, you know, water does not stay neatly within political boundaries. So, you know, if you are downstream of a site that's being developed and the local government upstream hasn't passed any ordinances to try and protect themselves, then there's not much that you can do. And that's part of the reason why we thought, you know, doing this, you know, the previous law was the way to go.
Well, what do you say to those who have argued that the prove it first provision really where you have to prove that there's been a mine that's successfully operated and been closed for 10 years before opening one in the state? What do you say to people who argue that, you know, we can provide examples, but it doesn't necessarily show the character of Wisconsin or some of the risks that may be involved with this particular project that would be considered?
Right. So, I mean, again, just kind of going back to ancient history, so part of what you're referring to is the way the Prove It First law worked was you could use any mine from North America to satisfy that. That provision to allow it to be from places other than Wisconsin was in itself a compromise way back when the law was passed. Initially, we had argued that it should be a mine in Wisconsin or from a similar, you know, place with similar geology and climate for exactly the reason that you laid out. So that is a potential problem. But when you take a look at all of the data and, you know, we was submitted to the committees on sulfide mining that is going on, it consistently, no matter where it's being done, has problems with acid mine drainage and heavy metal contamination. And that is, I think, just emblematic of the fact that that industry has not been willing to invest in the sort of control technology that could prevent it. And that's our concern.
So if you saw evidence of the kind of technology that could prevent it, would...
Then our analysis would be totally different.
Okay.
You know, our biggest concern is from the contamination point of view. You know, as was pointed out in our testimony, it's not the only problem that we have. We also have concerns about wetlands and just disruption of the surface and things like that. But, you know, our biggest concern has been particularly groundwater and surface water contamination from sulfide mining. So it would certainly change our analysis if we thought that there was technology out there that could prevent that kind of contamination. We still, you know, would want to know where it was being done and, like I said, what kind of other surface impacts are there going to be on, you know, either, you know, wetlands, flooding, things like that.
Again, you just heard from Lucas Weber with Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and Bill Davis with the state's Sierra Club chapter on their reaction to lawmakers' vote this week to repeal Wisconsin's moratorium on sulfide mines. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but stick around, there's more to come. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. We bring you a couple interviews that we hope to air last week about research on the state of the economy in a 15-county region across northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin. But with the news about UW-Superior suspending programs last week, we decided to delay them. As you may or may not know, Duluth hosted its annual Regional Economic Indicators Forum at the DEC. Students from several area colleges and universities presented their findings on the region's labor force, business confidence, and more. Monica Haynes is the director of the Business and Economic Research Bureau at the University of Minnesota Duluth. She and her students put together findings about the region's unemployment and workforce for the forum.
We look at a lot of different indicators, from the unemployment rate to labor force participation, different industry performance, such as which industries have added or lost jobs in the last few years, and wages. So for this specific topic, we were looking at occupations related to water resources, as well as some of the big gainers and losers over the last 5 years.
And did I hear that there are 3,500 jobs in the area for water resources or water resource jobs?
Yeah, I mean, that's an estimation. We use occupation codes to identify occupations that we felt were specifically related to water resources, although there are probably lots of ancillary jobs that are maybe not directly in water resources. For example, you know, employees at Minnesota Power or employees at Barr Engineering may be classified in different occupations, but they may still benefit from working with the water. So I would say the 3,500 is probably a low estimation.
Okay. Well, what were some of the key findings that you saw with regards to the labor market and workforce in the 15-county area that this covers?
Well, I think one of the really important findings continues to be the decline in the labor force. There has been a pretty dramatic increase in the states of Minnesota and Wisconsin in terms of labor force participation over the past 6 or 7 years, while our region has seen a decline overall during that time. And so other parts of the state are seeing an influx of workers, and our businesses are having a hard time finding enough workers to fill all the jobs that they have.
And it sounded like there were a number of factors that are impacting that, or that they feel are impacting that, including housing?
Yeah, one of the issues or the limits of hiring was housing, although I think cost of workers was up there, and competition among other businesses for similar positions. So how significant is the disparity, I guess, between the state of Minnesota and Wisconsin to our area? I mean, is it pretty stark contrast?
I'm not sure exactly what the jobs to opening, or there's a survey that the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development does every 6 months that measures the amount of job postings compared with the number of workers that are applying for those jobs. And I know in recent years it has gotten to the point where there's about one employee for every job that's posted. And of course there's some inconsistencies between the people and their qualifications and whether they're qualified for the jobs that are being posted. So of course it's not a perfect comparison, but it does show that we're kind of approaching the peak employment in terms of, you know, we are at the point where there's about one job for every person looking.
So I guess then what markets or what sectors are doing well right now and which ones are having more trouble?
Healthcare continues to do really well and has continued to add jobs over the past few years. The mining industry did suffer quite a bit over the past couple years. I think it has started to rebound, but not as quickly as many would like. Professional and scientific jobs were one of the big gainers from this most recent data. And had grown about 14% over the past 5 years. So that shows that there are more people being added in more technical and scientific areas. But then again, a lot of the openings are in low-paying jobs like the service industry and retail and sales. So there's kind of a disconnect between, you know, people who want to earn a living wage and the jobs that are available, and, you know, making sure that they can find qualified people while maybe not being a really high quality job.
Well, trying to sustain a living.
Yeah, exactly.
So what do you feel are the key takeaways from your aspect of the research that you've done?
Unemployment rates continue to fall, so that's good news for workers. I guess the market is really turning into a market that benefits employees, and I would say that the challenge for our region will be to bring people into the labor force that maybe have been on the sidelines for the last few years, you know, marginally employable people, so people with criminal backgrounds, people with disabilities, people who maybe had left the labor market during the recession and now are finally considering coming back, parents who maybe can't afford childcare. If we could remove some of the barriers to employment for people who are maybe considering entering the job force but not really ready because of something that's limiting them, if we were able to remove some of the barriers for those individuals, we might be able to increase that number.
Again, that was Monica Haynes, Director of the Business and Economic Research Bureau at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Up next, we hear from Saqib Mahmood. He is an assistant professor of sustainable management and economics at UW-Superior. He studies applied economics with a focus on environmental and natural resources. Mahmood and his students examined the financial indicators of companies in northern Minnesota and Wisconsin.
What we do is actually we pick 14 companies. Now we have 14 companies that those companies have significant presence in this region. Some of them are heavily invested in the local economy, like Elite, like which owns Minnesota Power and Superior Water, Light and Power, and, you know, you can say also Calumet, Polymet, you know, and of course there are other companies like Marriott International and U.S. Steel. They're of course entire USA based, but they also have a bit of like significant presence here as well. So basically we have these 14 companies and we try to come up with an index, like if we invest $100 from year 2009, how this $100 is performing, and compare it to Standard & Poor 400 mid-cap index. And what the students showed in this presentation and the research, we found that that Reef Index, based on these 14 companies, are outperforming the S&P 400 mid cap.
They're outperforming.
You know, the reason is good news, or in a way also give us some indication why it is happening. The reason is because it's more dependent on those commodity prices, which are, if you, there's another figure that the student showed that is actually imitating the oil price, future oil price fluctuations. So it shows that our region is more dependent on these commodity prices. It's better to diversify because commodity price, you know, is lots of uncertainty involved, the fluctuations. So it's better to diversify, especially I can see lots of potential in the technology sector and the hospitality industry we can tap in. Mining is there, tourism is there. Of course, I'm not trying to say that we should move away from mining. All those industries should be there, our strength, but what we can add so that the millennials, the younger generations, will see two things here: jobs, which will improve their quantity of life, and also what about the nature, the park, the quality of life. So if we can blend in, what is the optimal mix? That is the idea, right? What is the blend we can bring in here, the quantity of life and the quality of life, so that the young couples will stay put. The students that we are having now, once they graduate, they feel like, I want to work here, rather than, you know, moving towards those big city attraction.
So let me ask you a question, because I'm not super up on commodity prices.
Right, right.
I know that we had the dip back in, what is it, started in 2014, where oil prices fell really low.
Right, right, right.
Now it seems like they're back up to, I don't know.
Going up, you know, not like, of course, that level, but of course it's going up. And if you see in our findings, the Reef Index is actually imitating. Not like the exact percentage fall or percentage up, but as if like it's imitating, like that fall and then going up, you know? So it shows, that's what I was trying to say, that our industry, maybe our the companies which are, has significant presence in the reef region, more dependent on this oil, the mining, you know, those kind of resources. Even our transportation logistics, they are basically supplying what? The coal, the taconite. So everything is related with these commodity prices. So if the commodity prices goes up, the region will do well. But if the commodity prices go down, the region will do bad. We have unemployment, all those kind of problems. So it's better to have a portfolio. That's what we economists say, portfolio basket. Like, we don't have to depend on two or three industries significantly. Can we diversify? So that's my message, if you ask me, what I have learned with the students for this project.
You know, the research that you did on these 14 companies,
right, good
to diversify the economy.
Right, that's the idea. That's the idea. Like, if we can, especially I can see lots of potential in the technology sector. There's a company called Faceto in Superior. Not many people know about it, but they came up with a watch which can carry 20 gigs of data, 20 gigabytes of data. So you see, like, they've got an award in the Silicon Valley. So how many people know about this company? You know, so that means we have to make sure these people are at the forefront, and we can encourage the young generation to tap into this technology sector, and of course the other sectors which can help. Not only this, you know, I would say spin-off from this tourism, of course mining is there. What about the recreation industries based on this water resource that we have over here, and the technology sector, you know? And future, I think, looks bright if we do it, you know, the right way. It's all about making sure whatever the research we are doing or the findings, there's a connection with the policymakers, the decision makers, the stakeholders. Then we can move forward in a positive manner. Otherwise, what I fear, we might lose that opportunity or miss the bus, well, you can say. Because in California, they have the other way around, the problem, the water resource. There are certain parts of California, they are now going for water rationing. Here, we have abundance of water. So if we do our policies the right way, who knows? We might tap in those entrepreneurs with lots of maybe financial backing, come over and invest here. But if we don't showcase like what we can offer, they will probably go to other place, right? So it's a, you know, bit of like, of course, we have to think ahead, you know, not like the short term, but also in the long term.
Again, that was Saqib Mahmood, an economics professor at UW Superior. That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also find us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM, and you can find us on iTunes under Hear Me Out. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.